So I was fascinated to learn that you're somebody who's very passionate about bees. I've always been interested in bees, not just in terms of the science of complexity, but because I spent many years living in Turkey, and they always pride themselves over their wild honey. Uh-huh. But I didn't realize until I started reading more about you that you've actually trained to be a beekeeper.
Inadvertently, that's true. I grew up on a farm, and I was a Boy Scout. And you used to go to Boy Scout camp every summer. And when you're in Boy Scout camp, you take merit badge classes. And I was a really nerdy Boy Scout, surprise, surprise. And I saw there was a bookkeeping merit badge. And I signed up because I wanted to learn accounting that summer. And so I signed up for bookkeeping, only to be informed there was a typo and I had signed up for beekeeping. And I actually fell in love with beekeeping. And when I came home, I ordered a beehive from Sears, from the Sears catalog, and the bees from the Sears catalog. And I would watch those bees, and I learned something. A bee is an animal. It's made of cells, like all animals. But that the bunch of bees come together, and they actually form another animal. It really is another animal. The beehive is an animal. And that sounds almost like a metaphor, but it isn't. It reproduces. Like the hive reproduces, not just bees. It has a memory that's independent of the bee's memory. It knows how to do things. It has emergent properties that no bee knows how to do. It's a warm-blooded animal. It holds its body temperature at 97 degrees, whereas bees are cold-blooded animals, and so forth. In fact, there is an old tradition that when the beekeeper dies, you actually go and tell the hive. And they did that when, I believe, Queen Elizabeth died. They went and told the royal bees that she had passed. And what happened is a long time ago, when I would watch those bees and I learned that hive was an animal, I asked myself a question, which was, is the same true of humans? Is a group of humans an animal that's different, that exists on a different time scale? And again, this isn't metaphysics. It wouldn't be like religion or anything. This would simply be a biological fact. Your cells come together and make you. Do people come together and make a higher organism? I didn't know what I thought when I started writing this most recent book, but I left it being convinced that it's true. And I named the organism Agora, after the noisy Greek marketplace of old, where all the humans interacted.
I'm in Austin today, and I'm sitting in the office of Byron Rees, the acclaimed author, futurist, entrepreneur, and as I've learned, world traveler and photographer. This seems to be a very appropriate time to be talking about the future of the cosmos and superorganisms, given that just yesterday we were watching the total solar eclipse, Austin being in the path of totality. I mean, and I know you organized incredible photos and to document this of your house. I mean, I was blown away because this was the first eclipse I'd ever seen. And nothing really prepares you for that moment where you sort of enter that twilight zone of darkness. All the animals go quiet. Their circadian rhythms have all been disturbed. But you really get that sense of the interconnectivity of everything, I think, in that moment of blackness.
It is wonderful. You hear audible gasps.
Yeah.
People have a transcendent moment.
Yeah.
You know, when we first started talking, you mentioned the overview effect, which is, of course, the what astronauts, when they go up and they see the whole of the Earth from afar, and they have this kind of sense of this oneness of humanity. And that's what I wrote the Agora book for, because we can't send everybody into space. But if there is this creature that we're all part of, and I believe it's provable, but if there is such a creature, then what follows from it is, you know, the left hand doesn't have to like the right ear, but the left hand needs to understand that there's no scenario where it wins and the ear loses, or vice versa. That if we are actually all part of a single animal, then we actually succeed or fail together. And that's what I think the Agora book answers the question, why are we here? And it answers it scientifically. And science does not like why questions. It never answers why questions. It loves how. But I think I can say scientifically why we are here.
Why questions tend to be teleological.
Correct. But I would love to say why we're here. If when we get to that point, I would love to tell you my scientific answer to that question.
I would like to get to that. But maybe, you know, for starters, we should define a little bit for everyone who's listening. What actually is a superorganism?
A superorganism is a living creature made up of other living creatures.
Right. Like a beehive. Like you.
Correct. It's a simple sentence, but it's a huge idea. And what people don't usually realize is that humans are superorganisms. Individual, you are a superorganism because you're made of cells and they're alive. Your cells are alive.
Right.
If I take you apart a cell at a time and put each of those cells in a petri dish, it will live on, but you will vanish. And where did you go? Were you ever even there? So you're a different level of order, right?
And obviously there's that kind of critical mass point where if you take enough of my cells away, I stop being me.
Right.
But
right.
but there's this moment of, you know, almost like a tipping effect, or, you know, you get a sort of a shift, a transition, you know,
correct,
between cells and me.
Right. And what that would be is when it happens because the cells themselves are differentiated. If you were all the same exact kind of cell, you would just be a pile of cells. That's all you would be.
Right.
We have about 300 different types of cells. And so there's all this differentiation, which means there's all this specialization. And the interaction of those cells produces emergent properties. And that is what you are. You are this emergent thing that comes about by the interaction of them. But to be clear, you don't share. You share the same physical matter as your cells, but you are not yourself a cell. It isn't that the cells have half your body and you have half of it. It's you're a different level of order superimposed upon them. And that's why there's no logical reason that can't keep going up, that a bunch of yous don't come together and form another creature. Now, your cells have no knowledge that you're here, that you live or anything. They have no way. Even if they were intelligent, they wouldn't be able to perceive you. When your platelets run off to clot your cut finger, they're not thinking, oh, he cut his finger again. Oh, I think again. They're just living their lives and they give rise to this. And I think that's true with humans. 300 kinds of cells in a person? Well, we have the Bureau of Labor and Statistics in the U.S. tracks 10,000 different jobs. And I think those are people doing their job are analogous to different cells.
So we think of you as a kind of a higher level order of all these cells, bacteria, mm-hmm. all of these things that, you know, even under entities that we're coexisting in our space. But the concept of you is itself not an uncontroversial one. And I was very uh-huh. interested when I was reading, because you described it, you know, we can think of this in terms of systems theory, in terms of, you know, traditional religious notions of the soul. I mean, one of the things that really struck me is that if you kind of look at the path of neuroscience and, you know, even Buddhism, there's kind of this convergence now around this idea that there is no you, that the voice in your head is kind of just the PR department interpreting the various stimulation, the decisions that the autonomous agents within your body are making, and tells you a story about what that means. But the story is not necessarily the center of your consciousness and being.
There is a lot to support that.
Yeah.
There are all the experiments that show...
and 3,000 years of Indian philosophy.
Fair enough, yes, yes. But there are, you know, the experiments that show you basically make decisions before and then you justify them later, and it's your body acting autonomously and all that. I don't have to come down on that one way or the other. It's sort of like free will. I don't have to come down on that one way or the other to further the idea, a simple question, which is, do a group of people come together and form an organism? Does that organism think? Does that organism have a will? Does that organism have a self? I mean, I think the answer is yes. Is that organism conscious? Probably. If consciousness comes about from complexity, Agora is vastly more complex than we are.
Is Agora just a superorganism of people?
Uh-huh.
Right. So do you see that as being nested in within like a larger superorganism like Gaia, you know, which is...
Correct. Right. So the Gaia hypothesis actually is very key to the whole thing. The Gaia hypothesis, as you no doubt know, but for the benefit of the listeners, is a theory put forth by a man named James Lovelock, who only recently passed away at 102. And he says that the Earth, this is really fascinating, the Earth is a living system that self-regulates and holds certain values within ranges that are conducive to life. And that's a lot of words when it comes out. But basically this, the salinity of the oceans is held constant, even though you would think, well, they shouldn't. Every day, rivers dump more salts into the ocean. So how, and then water evaporates. Why aren't they getting salt here? Well, there's a mechanism that, that counteracts that. The amount of oxygen in the air is held constant. Why would it? All of these things are held within these narrow ranges that are conducive to life. Even the Earth heats and warms itself over the time, because what happens is, you know, all the glaciers melt, then the Earth, then the mountains rise, and then the volcanoes blow stuff up, and then it darkens the Earth, and then water freezes, and it pushes it all back down. I mean, don't take a lot of comfort in that. It happens on geological time. Like, in a million years, it'll right itself. Like, yeah. it's not going to save us next year or anything, but that the Earth does that. And so that is that all living things on the Earth come together, and that the Earth functions like a living system. Lovelock was never clear if he believed it was alive. I think he did, but he never would say it. Agora is a little different, completely different. Agora says, it's like the beehive. Is the interaction of humans, does that bring about differentiation? And when we interact, does that bring about neo-emergent properties? For instance, not a person alive who knows how to make a smartphone. There's not a human being who knows how to make a smartphone. Nobody could go mine the cobalt and do the, and yet smartphones get made. And so the question is, well, who makes the smartphones? And the question, the answer is, Agora knows how to make a smartphone. No person could put somebody on the moon, and yet people are put on the moon all the time.
But you know, when you look at the behavior of people as a collective, they kind of sit at either ends of the spectrum. You've got the wisdom of crowds on one side, mm-hmm. where a group of people of average intelligence could be smarter than an expert. I mean, that's something that's been discussed and researched for some time. And then you've also got the madness of crowds, mm-hmm. you know, where basically people act like a mob. Their mm-hmm. level of stupidity seems to get exponentially augmented by the presence of more of them. So I mean, are these all just different faces of Agora?
Yes, but I'd like to think about it at a, I'm gonna think about it like occupations. Two bricklayers who've never met each other can come together, and with exchanging a few words, they're gonna lay bricks fundamentally the same way. Hmm. And they're able to build this structure. A bunch of taxi drivers in New York kind of efficiently distribute themselves, even though there's no one of them in charge. They're all like a certain kind of bee doing a certain job.
Yeah.
And by the way, in a superorganism, if you don't do your job right or you act weird, they kill you.
Yeah.
And we do the same thing. We criminalize deviation from the norm. If you're a neurosurgeon and you're like, yes, I know how I was taught, but I do it differently. You know, that's a legal liability, right? Like, we enforce a lot of conformity. So I would think of it like people, there are all kinds of emergent capabilities of humans, but one of them is certainly the kinds of things we create, our technology. And I think that comes about by a bunch of people doing their jobs. The superorganism, by the way, can get sick. I tell a story in the book, and really it's sort of the conclusion of the book. It is that in 1947, this man in San Francisco committed suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And there happened to be a psychologist at Stanford who heard about this and the same day. And he went up there to just look into it, because he studied suicide. And he went to the man's apartment. And the man had been single, nothing wrong with him, lived alone, but he had left a suicide note. And nobody in particular, just this note. And it said, I'm going to walk to the bridge now. If one person smiles at me along the way, I will not jump. And that's the great tragedy, is nobody smiled at him. And that's really, I think people put a lot on themselves about, like, they have to figure out what to do with their life or something. But the superorganism, if you look at a clock, the biggest gear in the clock is not the most important gear. The clock works because all the gears mesh and work together. And all it actually takes to build utopia, I think, are people smiling at the stranger. The simplest things make the superorganism. Superorganism can do anything. Agora can do anything. Agora can put a person on the moon. Agora can deflect an asteroid, but only to the extent we all, that it functions.
Well, this interesting thing about the story that you shared, though, is that is the one documented case of the person for whom there was no intervention. But presumably, every day, there are people who Absolutely. Don't jump over the bridge. And I kind
that's
of...
It, that's it working.
Yeah, and I kind of think, you know, if you're kind of thinking, what is the ultimate purpose of this conglomeration of people operating at this high level of order, it could almost be a kind of an experiment, like of a path exploration of all the different configurations, actions, decisions taken in disparate circumstances that lead to different conclusions. You almost like, it's almost like slime mold exploring a maze.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's we all think of ourselves as complex, but we follow simple rules mm-hmm. of interaction which lead to emergent behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing mm-hmm. so, we're exploring a universe of possibilities.
I don't know. I don't really think of it that way. I'm not. That's not my delicate way to say I disagree. I think one of the most interesting things I know is that life formed on this planet almost immediately before it had completely cooled, and it evidently only ever happened once. We know that because all life is related. You can take a gene from a slime mold and put it in a human, and it's the same
right.
DNA. So it happened once, or it only persisted once, right? And I think that's very interesting. How did it happen immediately? Oh, and by the way, because it's all the same, it's enormously complex, right? The double helix and all of that. It somehow it began like that. And I think the only logical explanation for that is that it came from somewhere else.
Right,
and that's called panspermia, and not directed panspermia like aliens planet is here or anything like that.
In that it evolved somewhere else, and then we got a kickstart. So
what happened is, our sun is a third generation sun. There have been two other ones before it, and so all along you get these planets and they form, and life grows there, and then they get hit by an asteroid. It will happen, blowing it into smithereens, and then all of that biological matter just drifts around. And some of it eventually just lands on another place, and it takes root, and it's fully formed.
Yeah.
And it grows, and it spreads, and then it gets hit. You see, Richard Dawkins. Oh, Richard Dawkins, who didn't believe the Gaia hypothesis because he said natural selection couldn't work at that level. And I think it does. I think...
If you take a macro scale, right?
Yeah, my falsifiable prediction is we will find alien life and it will be GTCA DNA. It will be our DNA. Because I think it's all over the universe and that's how life spreads.
That's good news for, you know, Star Trek. Because, I mean, that's the whole thing is that aliens end up looking like us.
I know. And speaking English, by the way. But I think that, you know, there are flowers that reproduce when wind just blows the biological matter. And I love the idea that plants and planets actually reproduce the same way. And I think that is it.
Well, you know, one of the...
So to bring all that home.
Yeah.
So life that fails to reproduce dies out. And so we're part of that giant... We're part of natural selection. We're the kind of life that I think that's what we are. We're part of this giant cosmic story that has gone on for billions of years before us and billions of years after us.
The thing that kept going through my mind as I was reading in your book about the emergent properties of Agora and so the collective behavior of humanity was the other example you gave where you were talking about how, say, bees and flowers co-evolve.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me we're at this very particularly interesting moment in history where artificial intelligence has reached a level of not just sophistication, but integration now into our daily lives. So it is actually, the things we've been talking about for 50 years is happening. The possibility of co-evolution of humans and machines, both organic and silicon matter. And so I kind of wonder, you know, is the kind of the next version of Agora something that incorporates these non-organic computational systems?
That would not be impossible.
When you think Gaia, the Gaia mm-hmm. hypothesis includes both living and non-living things.
Absolutely. That's a well-taken point. I talk about technology as an amplifier of human ability,
right.
And that's what it is. And so to that extent, the technology acts through us and amplifies what we're able to do, and that is its thing. I mentioned to you that I had a podcast for the longest time. One of the most boring podcasts ever, because it's just two people talking about artificial intelligence for like an hour and a half at a time. And I ask every one of my guests two questions.
But you were doing this before AI was popular with anybody else.
You were one of the originals. Well, it was nice. You're right. I would have people talk to me because nobody... Yes, absolutely. But I had the most amazing people on the show. And I asked them all this two questions.
Yeah.
The first question is... do you believe general intelligence is possible? And all but three said yes.
Okay.
I would be one of the three, I would be the fourth one to say no. And I preface all of that to say my views on that topic are in the extreme minority. And so I never want to represent that the way I look at that.
This is why you're on the show.
that the way I look at it is somehow what the way most people are.
So why?
Well, I would reverse the problem and say, I would ask them why they believe that it is true. Because everyone agrees we don't know how to make it. Like, we haven't made it. We don't have general intelligence yet.
Well, how do you define?
So that's a fair question. So we have... weak AI or narrow AI, whatever you want to call it, where we have essentially automated a task. We've taught it to spot spam in your email or navigate a car or something. Yeah. And then we have something else, a theoretical thing, which is what you see in the movies, like Ex Machina or Commander Data in Star Trek or C-3PO in Star Wars. And that's an AI that can teach itself new things. It can learn new things. It can be creative. It can figure things out.
So, you know, and
this, so you reject the idea that there's a distinction?
Well, I mean, I am also of the view in that the most expansive definition of intelligence is not something that I think we can easily achieve, nor necessarily is it something we would want.
Mm-hmm.
In that the usefulness of a machine for me is like the usefulness of a hammer. Mm-hmm. When you pick it up and you can hit a nail, it doesn't talk back to you. Mm-hmm. You know, it just does what its job. The minute you need a psychotherapist, you know, to figure out why your machine is not functioning properly, making decisions, you're actually created a less efficient machine.
Mm-hmm.
So the way they're talking about general intelligence now, it kind of a system that can, you know, take a problem apart, plan, strategize, doesn't really feel like the AGI we were talking about 10 years ago,
uh-huh.
which felt more like digital consciousness. I feel like we've lowered the barriers of success now, you know, which we may achieve.
Well, I think maybe we can agree that humans have something called general intelligence. Would that be fair?
Like, yeah.
Well, however you want to define it, we have it.
In the inability to master new skills, synthesize information.
And so when I would ask these people, why do you believe you can build machines with general intelligence, they would all said the same thing, because we are machines. With general intelligence,
right,
and that is the core assumption, and that is that people are machines, and you don't have to actually appeal to the soul to reject that notion that we are not machines.
This is the crux of it, and these are a lot of the people who were basically thinking the thing holding us back from building a digital human was compute.
Uh-huh.
You know, if we throw enough computational power at this to match the level of the human brain, somehow we will get to that critical mass of cells where, you know, we have a living person. And I don't believe that.
Well, I don't either. I mean, but that was the whole idea of the Human Brain Project in Europe. They were like, well, yeah, we have a great model, let's just emulate it.
Or do you remember they had people who would sit down teaching machines things.
Right.
You know, like, this is the way a road works. This is the way a tree is.
Do you know about the nematode worm?
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, you basically have...
Yeah.
C. elegans, and you have a 20 years people have tried to figure out how the 302 neurons in its nervous system interact to achieve the behaviors, and they don't even know if it's possible to figure that out. And so the idea that our 100 billion we're going to somehow emulate, but I think at a bigger thing, you know, we have these brains that we don't really understand how they work all that well. Like, if I were to ask you the color of your first bicycle or the name of your first grade teacher, generally you can recall that stuff even if you haven't thought about it in a long time. And we're not really sure how you do that trick. And then your brain gives rise to your mind, which is everything that your brain can do that doesn't seem like something an organ could do, like have a sense of humor. Your heart doesn't have a sense of humor, and yet somehow, so you got the mind, and then somehow, the mind is able to achieve consciousness, which is the experience of the universe. We know what consciousness is. It's that a thermometer can measure temperature, but you can feel warmth. And we don't know how it is that matter can have an experience of something. We don't know that. So I would put it back on people to say we have brains that we don't understand, that give rise to minds we don't understand, that give rise to consciousness. Why do you believe we can build all that in a fab? Why do you believe that's a machine that you can manufacture? And I think that's an act of faith beyond what I am capable of. I do not believe we are machines. And also, by the way, I will say two quick things. I was all through that podcast, all these people were telling me we were going to have like this huge job. All these jobs were going to vanish because we're going to have machines do it. And they would always have this 5-year timeline. And you know, 5 years has come and gone twice since then. And I can't think of a single job we've eliminated in the last 5 years, not one. And the idea that, and I have spent a lot of ink figuring out the half-life of a job, and I think it's 50 years. I think every 50 years we lose about half the jobs.
Yeah.
I don't have a sense it's going any faster, and I will say...
Well, there's very few companies that get to 100, so that kind of makes sense.
There you go, right. Of the original Dow companies, none of them are left. The last one dropped off in the GE. But I have a deep belief that any job that a machine can do, if a machine can, in theory, do a job... If you make a person do that job, the word for that is dehumanizing. Because you're telling that person, I need you to be a machine I don't own, not a person. And if a machine can do it, it's beneath the dignity of people.
Well, there's a positive side to this story as well, which is we're at a time when we're not only challenging the nature of what people should do versus machines should do, or what the kind of potential synergistic relationship between the two are, but it's also a time of the explosion of knowledge in a new way. And I was really interested in the article you wrote recently about that ChatGPT's basically got a 4 billion year history, right? That this is the culmination of another level of order when it comes to thinking about information. Could you unpack that a little?
I love that. For the first 3.5 billion years of life, there was one place that data could be stored, and that was DNA. And it couldn't learn. It had to hope it mutated by chance. 500 million years ago, we got brains all of a sudden, a second place to store data. And if you just think of it that way, that's just a place to store data. And they could write and read to it very quickly through a process called learning. Then, and that gave us all this progress. And then about 5,000 years ago, we got a third place to store information, which was externally through writing. And that propelled us forward. And then a few hundred years ago, we learned how to do that inexpensively, and we started saving everything. Then we learned how to digitize it, and so forth. And every time gave us access to more information, humanity would take this gigantic leap upward. It used to always puzzle me, like, why did we go 200,000 years with almost no progress, and then in the last 5,000 years, we are up and to the right? And so I write, though, that even in the digital age, all of that information is completely siloed. When you do a search on Google, what is the difference between a cold and the flu? It will say, I found 30 million answers to that question. Here's the first one. Here's the second one. Here's the third one. And you don't want 30 million answers. And so all human knowledge is still compartmentalized in 50 billion, right now, web pages, or countless trillions of pages in libraries. It's all siloed. And so what LLMs are, they're the first attempt to consolidate all human knowledge into one place. That's a big deal. That's a big deal because what that is a planetary memory. There's actually one knowledge base. And now that we're hooking up sensors to collect information, all of a sudden, almost everything all humans have learned has been forgotten. Almost everything. 99. as many nines as you want to put percent. When you die, almost everything you know dies with you. Very little survives. And how much of that is still around in 500 years? Like, humanity's story is that we learn and die, and it always almost resets almost to zero. And all of a sudden, for the first time, that's not going to happen. We're going to have a planetary memory, and it's all going to be consolidated through this technology. And it will effectively, every human in the future will be wiser than any human who ever lived, because their decisions can be influenced by the life experience of millions of people who came before them.
So would a sufficiently advanced version of this essentially be a walkie-talkie to talk to Agora?
Yes. And again, I don't think humans lose agency in that world. If I have a metal detector and I go to the beach and I'm swinging that thing around and it goes beep, 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 I can dig wherever I want to. I can dig over there. I can say to that metal detector, you're not the boss of me. I'm going to go dig over there. But you'd be a fool not to dig over the beep, beep, beep of the part where it says there's something buried there.
Do you think that's really true? Because, you know, one of the things that I found most terrifying, and it's something that's always concerned me, is that complex systems only have emergent properties when they constitute individual components obey high degrees of conformity.
That is very true.
So, you know, if you basically have, you know, a rogue bee that's like a Sartre or a Nietzsche, you know, they're not going to be allowed to persist or their ideas propagate throughout the hive.
You are entirely right that superorganisms function because they demand conformity. And when I wrote the Agora book, I thought that was going to be the killer argument against humans being a superorganism, is that we pride ourselves that we're all individualistic, that we aren't. You know, we pick our clothes, we listen to music and all of that.
Maybe we're just more predictable than we think.
I think it is, well, first of all, we do require enormous amounts of conformity. I put in the book something about, like, start signing your emails in accordance with the prophecy and, you know, see if you get a promotion, or start wearing a cape and a monocle again and just see how that works out for you. I've never seen a person with half a mustache ever. Like, but even in non-silly ways, what I would say, and by the way, the educational system is designed to produce conformity, which we measure with standardized tests because we're trying to produce standardized people to do standardized jobs. That's deliberate. But it isn't, I don't see it quite that stark though, because what's important is that whatever your occupation is, whatever it is that you're doing that's part of that collective, that's where you have to have pretty rigorous conformity. You see, in manufacturing, any deviation is a flaw. Even if you make a better something, perfection is measured by its ability to be like all the other parts. And so it is important that if you're a neurosurgeon, that generally speaking, you do it the way the other neurosurgeons are. But I don't think it makes us automatons in every aspect of life. We don't all order the same food and menu.
So I guess finally, you know, what does this frame really give us in terms of making better decisions as a society? Like, to be able to understand the emergent properties of humans, a flock of humans in a sense, like, what does that collective viewpoint change our perception of reality?
For me, the way it changed me is when it finally became real for me was when I was sitting in a city watching life and looking around the city and marking places where I saw knowledge had been encoded in the physical structures around me. And I realized that we were writing, as we lived in a city, we were encoding information in that city, and that could be accessed anyway. So I had kind of this epiphany. And for me, it meant that I think fundamentally we're here is because an asteroid's going to come to this planet and hit us someday. Like, that's a statistical certainty, right? And that planets that fail to evolve any living creatures to stop that fail to evolve intelligent creatures to stop that, are destroyed. But I wrote an entire book on why there's just one intelligent species on this planet. Why is it just us? I mean, argue for the dolphins all you want to and all that, but I mean, really, there's just us. I mean, there's us and everything else. We look like aliens to everything else. So why is there just one? And I think the answer is that intelligence is highly toxic, highly volatile substance. And that's one of the possible solutions to the Fermi paradox. Why isn't there aliens everywhere? Well, when you get smart enough, you get the ability to blow yourself up, and you inevitably do. And so while it is true that planets that fail to evolve an intelligent life form to protect it from that asteroid, which will hit it, The flip side is also true. Planets that evolve 20 intelligent life forms, or 40 or 60 or any number, end up blowing themselves up too. And that the Goldilocks number is one. One is still very risky. It's very risky. But you have to have one to protect the planet from the asteroid. We're already building the DART probe, which went up and tried to hit an asteroid to deflect it. We're already doing that. And so that's what Agora is for, is to protect the life on this planet. And that's why there's just one of us. And it has happened so many times. It's just natural selection. Planets that overproduce intelligence, they all die out. Planets that underproduce it, they die out. But there's this thin, frequent, they produce maybe one. And they live and they go on and populate other planets. And again, spread through the galaxy. And so that's my why. We're here to protect the life on this planet. Is that teleological? Maybe. But it isn't outwardly directed. It's just natural selection. So what that does for me as an individual is I no longer think I have to, quote, save the world. I don't think anybody has to save the world. I think you have to smile at the person you're passing. You have to... Agora can do anything. Agora will be able to defend this planet from the asteroid, but only to the extent that the parts are working. And so I encourage people to put no heavier burden on themselves than this. Every day, try to be as nice as you can be, and try to be a slightly better person than you were yesterday. And that's all it will take us to build utopia.